A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
You're listening to the Sherlock's Podcast, your guide to a more stylish life. Hello, I'm Georgie Corridge-Cole, Sherlock's founder and CEO, and welcome to today's In Conversation With Podcast. Even in 2024, the finance world is largely considered to be a male-dominated industry. The two women I'm joined by today are at the top of their game and have proven that it is possible for women to have an equal seat at the table. Mimi Rushton is co-head of Global FX Distribution and Risk Solutions Group at Barclays. She's responsible for coverage of both corporate and institutional clients, and she has a master's in engineering from Cambridge. I'm also joined by Lou Empsom, who is a director in markets at Barclays within the credit sales team covering bank desks and hedge funds. Stay with us if this has sounded quite dry. She's also worked at Credit Suisse and Citibank during her decade-long career. And today they're joining me to talk about how they broke into the industry, how they've climbed the ladder, what a day looks like in their worlds. It's fascinating. And to share some of the lessons they have learned along the way. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having
Great
us on.
To have you. Well, I have to say that I met you both at an event you hosted and you kindly had me on a panel. And we talked on that panel about being a woman and being an entrepreneur and whether the panel and I felt that it had held us back in our careers. And I was really able to answer that it hadn't. And it was chatting to you afterwards and to some of the other women in the room. It was a brilliant event that Barclays hosted at the Natural History Museum. Talking to them, that sort of made me realise that, you know, there's been huge progress, but there's still a really long way to go. And, you know, I work in a world that girls come out of university into their careers and sort of think, I want to go into what Sherlock's does and it's all very glamorous. And yeah, you are here to prove that you can still, you know,
there's glamour in finance.
Yeah, there is. No, they're not mutually exclusive. Anyway, you look gorgeous. Thank you for joining us today. Can we start with a bit of a summary back to sort of end of your education, university? I mean, Cambridge, engineering, wow.
Yeah, that was pretty, it was pretty intense. I'll definitely tell you my story first because Lou's is way more impressive. So, yeah, I started, I left school and was fortunate enough to go and study engineering at Cambridge. And it was something that I did really to keep my options open. So it wasn't that I necessarily thought I was definitely going to be an engineer. It was more about, okay, let me do something that doesn't close me off from anything. And went through that and surprisingly had lots of debt at the end of it, unsurprisingly, I should say. And so was really focused on doing a job that was going to make me money.
Can I ask you a question? To do engineering at Cambridge, what are you going to be good at school?
STEM subjects, so maths, further maths, physics and chemistry were my A-levels. Okay. Look, I'd come from a background where actually we weren't very fortunate at all. So my mum had ploughed me into education. This was the thing that was going to get me out of the hole kind of thing. So I happened to be good at maths. I happened to be good at sciences. So it was about trying to find a path that I was going to be able to drive something there. And so hence, looking at finance made a huge amount of sense because I needed to pay off the 16 grand's worth of debt, which was, it felt huge at the time. So I did a load of interviews and ended up at a different bank, but they put me in a grad program that took me around all different parts of financial institutions. So I actually started in marketing. So it wasn't on the trading floor. Yeah. So it was completely different and eye-opening. But then within about a year, I had met the head of financial markets at then Lloyd's. That's where I started. And he was like, I think you should stop doing this immediately and come and work on a trading floor. You are meant for this job. So 2004, I'm on a trading floor.
And how many other women are on the trading floor?
Oh, it was not very many at all. Heavily outnumbered. But what's funny is that for me, that wasn't strange because I'd just done an engineering degree where I was massively outnumbered anyway. So it kind of wasn't in my head that this was a massive issue or something to be worried about. So I stayed there for a few years and then wanted to learn a bit more. So moved to Barclays to do a slightly different role that covered both interest rates and foreign exchange. And that was in the middle of the financial crisis. So an amazing time to be watching financial institutions evolve and see that change. And looking back on it now, it was kind of an incredible training. And then over time, I took on more and more responsibility, went and had my daughter in 2015. And then whilst I was on maternity leave, I asked my boss for a bigger job, which we can delve into later. Because I think that that was a moment of absolute bravado and madness, but one that I'm really proud of in a way, because it set a whole load of other things going. And he was incredible and true to his word, gave me a bigger job when I came back. So I looked after the business that I had at the time, which was co-running UK Corporate FX. But then I also took on commodities, which was something that I knew nothing about. So that was amazing. Fast forward another 18 months, the commodities business was something that we needed to wind down. And then the same boss turned around to me and said, Mimi, you know, you'd never go to America, would you? Because you really love your family and your mum. You're super close. And I was like, hold on a second. Let's not count me out quite yet. So I went home and had this amazing conversation with my family and sort of said, right, shall we go to America? And so we did.
Did you?
Yeah. So I spent 3 years in the States. In New York. It was the most incredible experience, reorganizing a team there.
And this is for Barclays?
This is all for Barclays. And we're so proud of what we had achieved, kind of running that business, growing it to what it is today, frankly, and it still continues. And at that time, I was running the corporate part of the business, and there was another phenomenal woman who I'm still co-head with now, who was running the institutional part of the business. And when our boss left, they elevated the two of us into the co-global head roles. But we were both in New York, so that wasn't really going to work. So I came back to London. And yeah, so that kind of, a very diverse and different journey. And a one that, frankly, I would never have plotted for myself if I were standing there in 2004.
I feel like we need a separate podcast on a sort of 101 of commodities trading, FX, foreign exchange, how it all works. Because it is fascinating, but it is another language.
100%.
If you're listening and going, my God, what is commodities trading? What is for? How does that work? We'll come back to that, because it is fascinating. I've had to really consciously try and get my head around that vocabulary over the years. And just in terms of seniority now, I mean, I know you are both hugely highly regarded at Barclays. Sort of, where are you in there? And where is there? What comes next? And
It's a good question. So
It sounds like a pretty huge title.
It is a huge title. So I guess two levels down from the executive committee.
Right.
So pretty high up. But it's what's been amazing about it, actually, is the people that have come on that journey with us. And so the bit that I'm most proud of, actually, is the team and the organization that we have around us. So I don't sort of wake up in the morning and think, God, I'm senior. This is amazing. But instead, I'm like, do you know what? We've really progressed and we've done some amazing things. And I've seen people achieve incredible things through their careers, as well as pushing the organization forward. So that for me is more of the driver than necessarily the seniority. But to your point about women being senior in finance, then yeah, I guess I can have that badge. I can represent.
And can I ask, you're sort of early 40s?
Yes, 42. Okay. 42 and proud.
I thought we were sort of the similar age at 43. So
yeah.
God, phenomenal. And that's really cool, because, you know, I feel as women, and we can come to that, we've sort of got so many years ahead of us. And
there's
quite a lot to navigate in your 30s, 40s, particularly with motherhood. That's cool to be at that level and have a really long stretch ahead of you. I was with my sister-in-law, who is very senior in the world of tax, and she's 50, and it's like, God, she's got so many years to achieve. Her children have just grown up and just sort of spreading their wings and going off. And I'm like, the world is your oyster. And she's just, I'm just going to watch her kill it. I know. It's very cool. Lou, tell us your story. After school, what happened?
So similar to Mimi, at school, economics, maths. I loved history and did chemistry as well. Which kind of led me on to an economics and management degree at Bristol, which I loved. I had a great time at university.
Economics to me is the thing, like maths, Rishi, I'd park that if I were you. I'd focus on economics. You know, that is the thing that should be compulsory. Is that a degree you'd recommend?
I highly, highly recommend it. I think it's brilliant in terms of getting kind of real life experience, as it were, whilst you're at university, and talking about very relevant and kind of modern day topics. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that's very applicable as well when you leave university, whether you go into finance or do something completely different. Yeah. And I just think it's a great toolkit to have.
People always say, what's that thing that would send you back to university? And for me, it's a career in economics. I think it would be fascinating. Oh, wow. Anyway, so economics,
had a brilliant time at university, and in light of that, didn't do the kind of standard route of internships in the summer. So when I came out of Bristol, it was sort of that thing of, right, I know I want to go into finance, but the pipeline of getting a job in the UK is going to take me at least a year. So what are my other options and what else can I do? And at the time, the minimum wage in Australia was $25 an hour. It was really easy to get a working visa. So I think I went through the entire of our school directory, got every email address of every parent from the school, plus every other email address I could get my hands on, and just sent out an email saying, does anyone know anyone who works in finance in Australia and can you put me in touch? So got on a plane, went for coffee after coffee, networked my way around, and somehow found myself having a coffee with the CEO of Citi in Australia. And he gave me my job. Wow. So, yeah, it was crazy. I think from
those coffees, it's all about those.
It's all about networking and just the people that you meet and what kind of opportunities, what sort of doors that can open. But yeah, it was mad. I think I landed in Australia and 3 weeks later started my job on the Citi trading floor.
Wow.
It's just crazy.
And tell us about that. What were you trading? What was it like? The ratio of men to women?
Well, similarly to what Mimi was saying, the ratio of men to women obviously wasn't great. I think it's got a lot better in the industry over the last 10 years. Starting in Australia is obviously a lot smaller than London. So the first time I came to one of the London trading floors, it seemed, you know, just so, so huge in comparison to what I was used to. But it was a great place to start in terms of getting such a good perspective of how the different business areas work together. How does the financial system as a whole sort of work? How does a bank interact with pension funds, asset managers, hedge funds? Because it was just that much smaller, you really got a much kind of more holistic view of that.
Yeah.
I was there for nearly a year, then came back to London with Citi into credit sales on the London trading floor. Was there until 2019, then moved to Credit Suisse, and then kind of had one of those real crossroad moments in my career in August of 2021 when I left Credit Suisse and came over to Barclays, and I've been there ever since.
And I just can't believe that you sort of nonchalantly talk about the fact that you went to Australia and sort of just called all of these people and got a job.
And suddenly you're there on the trading floor at what, like 22 or something?
Yeah, exactly. I think I was 23 at the time.
And what is that for people that don't know? Because it's fascinating. I mean, we've all seen various films, but what is it like? Is it a huge adrenaline rush? And it's kind of aggressive and what as it looks, or is it very different these days?
I mean, I think it's definitely an adrenaline rush. When I've had a big day at work and you've done a great trade, I find I have to sort of take an hour or two at the end of my day to just calm down and, you know, really have that adrenaline buzz leave you. I think if you don't have a fire and a passion and get that kick out of the atmosphere that we work in and how fast paced it is and how exciting it is, then maybe the trading floor isn't necessarily for you. But I think if you enjoy that, it's very much part of our day-to-day. And I think it's one of the things that makes me love this as a career.
As a woman, as a female trader, I mean, we actually did a campaign with Barclays. This is not how we met at all, but it was about a year and a half ago now. And it was a big campaign we ran that performed brilliantly well. To this day, it's something we're really proud of. It was to encourage females to invest more because we are less risk averse and to see Barclays as a safe place. Anyway, this is not an ad, but that was the purpose of the campaign. And it was just a really interesting conversation because, yeah, we are risk averse. How do you find, do you think that makes you better at your job?
I think, well, it's exactly why we need you on the trading floor, Georgie, is because you've got a different perspective. I think that that's the beauty of it, is that there's this realization that's happened over the last 20, 30 years that if you have a group of people who all think the same way, ultimately you'll get one type of outcome. But if we have people that think about things differently, actually we'll get more successful outcomes in a variety of different situations.
Yeah.
And you see it sort of the most actually in unexpected circumstances. So day to day, you know, we'll pretty much be doing our jobs, and I don't think you would necessarily see a huge amount of differentiation between myself and my male colleague. But if a crisis hits or something goes wrong, typically we'll come at that problem from really different perspectives. And that's when you get that power of having a different view.
And what as a woman do you think you bring that your male colleagues don't? And look, we're obviously generalizing here, and I'm not out to get men. You know, the magic is when, you know, both genders come together and bring their different skills and their different...
Yeah.
What are the skills you think that you bring to your respective roles?
Well, I think, you know, especially when it comes to being in a sales role, a lot of people will say that women potentially have kind of a high EQ, can have a softer touch.
Yeah.
On a trading floor, there's often, you know, difficult situations or difficult conversations that you're having on a daily basis. Perhaps women have a kind of slightly softer or more kind of in tune way of approaching those types of conversations. And I think exactly as Mimi was saying, it's just about having the difference of opinion, the difference of perspectives. And, you know, at the end of the day, when you're covering a diverse client list, having people, you know, different people within your organization that can, you know, find common ground with the with those various different individuals, I think is so important.
Yeah.
If you had a group of salespeople that were all exactly the same, had the same interests, the same hobbies, you know, you're not really mirroring the client base that you have. And so I think that's definitely part of it.
Yeah, I think the empathy point is probably, if you wanted to make a generalization, that's probably it. Mm. I'd like to think that I'm a really good read of people. Mm. So thinking about how to get the best out of somebody or how to solve the problem in a way that the client really wants to see that kind of come across or happen for them. Like, there's something really, I think, skillful around delivering a message so that it lands well with somebody. I don't actually think that all of my male colleagues think that way. You know, so it's quite, it's a subtle thing. But I also think that they, over time, sort of appreciate me for that. Mm-hmm. That's kind of, if somebody wants to recruit someone, typically they'll have me interview them, particularly for senior roles, because I will just look for something completely different to them. So I do think it's that empathy, it's that read of people, it's the way that you can form connections. I think we do that differently, but also the problem solving part.
Yeah.
I just think, you know, I'm less likely, again, if we're generalizing, and I think that's unfair because there is a lot of different qualities actually across the floor, but I'm less likely to take a sledgehammer to something or a blunt instrument.
Yeah,
you know, it's going to be...
Less knee-jerk, Can you, I mean, for people listening that just don't know this world at all, don't know finance, can you just talk us through a day and what that looks like and what you're doing, Lou? Can you, who's more logical to start with?
Why don't you?
I guess our days would probably be quite different.
Yes.
So I'm at my desk every morning by 7 a.m. have the first sort of 15 minutes going through my emails, catching up on the news overnight, but I'll also have done that usually on the tube on the way to work. 7:15, we have our morning meeting. So what were the main things that happened in the markets yesterday? What do we want to trade today? What do we want to be focusing our energy on? Come out of that at about 7:45. And then from then on, it's literally kind of hitting the phone.
And markets open at...
So our market in credit is pretty OTC. OTC means over the counter. So we don't have as technical kind of open and closed times as you would in equities, for example.
Right.
So for us, we can start trading from the moment we get in and there's not really a specific end time. 7:45 is kind of messaging clients on Bloomberg Messenger that we use, calling them up on the phone.
And your clients are...
hedge funds and other bank desks as well.
Okay.
And with that, you're kind of calling them saying, I've got this great idea, I've got this great trade that I think you should look at.
And what might the trade, can you give us a fictional scenario?
So it really can be anything. You know, in credit, we're trading the debt of companies. So it can be something as specific as, we think that this company is going to really outperform for X, Y, and Z reasons. The catalyst is their results are coming up.
Yep.
So we think that you should sell a credit default swap on this company. Or it can be something that's very macro. So we think this about this upcoming ECB meeting, or we think
ECB?
The European Central Bank.
Thank you.
And what I do, it can be very macro sort of government policy, or very micro this company specific.
And those conversations start at 7:45.
Yeah.
And they go on as long as you continue them.
Yeah. I mean, it's very much kind of trying to tailor everything to your client. So depending on what's topical and what we've discussed in the morning meeting, I won't necessarily speak to every client every day about the same things. You know, that's really the skill set that you have as a salesperson, is trying to make each conversation and each thing you're pitching very relevant and tailored to that client. And yeah, then those conversations pretty much just go on all day. It's a very, you know, you're at your desk, you know, there's not much in terms of going for coffees in the day. I eat lunch at my desk every day. So, you know, it's pretty full on just trying to get trades done. And yeah.
And what's the team structure?
So within our hedge fund and banks team, there's five of us. But, you know, the broader credit sales team would be around sort of 40, 50 people. You know, it's all about trying to facilitate the movement of risk from one client to another within the account base that we all cover, you know, as a whole organization.
And do you work to team targets? And
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you really are operating as a team.
Yeah. Yeah. We have our budgets, which is always a fun conversation. that we're working towards in terms of revenue targets.
Here it is. That's probably one of the biggest shifts, is I think across the industry as a whole, is this acknowledgement that actually this is a team sport rather than.
And I'm saying it naively, thinking if you're on the trading floor, you're on your own with your own patch.
It really isn't. I mean, to be successful is to have that team mentality and that ability to cover clients, but for different asset classes altogether. Are we as joined up as we could be? Are we talking to the same people? So actually we could do a much better job of presenting a united front. You know, so we're always thinking about how we can be more of a team to maximize, frankly, how easy it is for our clients to deal with us, but also the success that we can have.
And how do you decide when to put the phone down? And is it, are you on the phone, are you?
Yeah, so I'd say it's a pretty even mix between being on the phone and on Bloomberg Messenger. The people who are absolutely amazing at our job can have two conversations at once. I'm hopeless at that, a phone conversation and having kind of another conversation typing out.
And is it hyper-focused in there?
Yes, I think, you know.
Like, I'd like to come and sit and be a flan.
But it's also fun. It's really fun. So I don't think I could imagine any more sitting in an office on my own without kind of the noise and the interaction that's happening around me. I've sort of now been somewhat conditioned to the fact that you have that energy. So it's really the energy is super constructive and people want everybody else to sort of succeed. So I think it's that perception doesn't always come across around trading floors, but it is, for me, it's a really fun place to be.
I'm sure. I can imagine the adrenaline is amazing. Do you, in your team, do you personally do a trade every day? What's the average number of trades you're doing? I mean, it's different, isn't it? Depending on what you're trading.
Yeah. I mean, if I haven't done a trade in a day, I'm not a particularly nice person to be around.
Is that right?
So, you know, the amount I do in a day will vary hugely. I think the most I've ever done would probably be kind of nearing towards 80.
Wow.
And a slow day would be something in the region of 5. But yeah, usually I'd say anywhere between kind of 10 to 30 would be an average day.
And how do you cope with the highs and the lows? How do you cope with the lows? I mean, the highs, we get it. Like, it's buzzy, you're there, you're working as a team, it's alive. Look, everyone's career has highs and lows, don't they? But, you know, it's pretty acute, I imagine, for you in particular. Men better than are dealing with that? Or is that just a misconception? What's your...
Yeah, I think
it's your approach.
In what we do, you definitely you really feel the wins and you really feel the losses. And so Mimi and I were having a really interesting conversation on the way over here around, you know, trying to only worry about the things that are within your control. And you know, trying to learn from when you have a quiet day or when you have a loss at work, trying to really reflect on what happened in that situation. What could I have done differently? How can I try and learn a lesson from this so that when I'm next in a situation that's similar, that I can sort of change the outcome to be something more positive? But yeah, I think the point that you said really resonated with me.
I think but I've had to work at it. So what we were talking about was the fact that earlier in my career, if something went wrong, it would eat me up inside. It would chew down for hours, maybe days.
Yeah.
And obviously that has an impact on your performance just in life, let alone kind of on the trading floor, etc. So I spent a lot of time thinking about how can I counter that? And in particular, you know, what Lou and I had been discussing was around Stoicism and the Greek philosophy of Stoicism. So that's exactly as Lou described, focusing on what I can control. What's my reaction to something? That's the thing that I can control. The thing that's happened, if somebody else has, you know, made a massive mistake, I can't control that, but I can control how I deal with it and then, you know, what I do next. And as a consequence, I'm not perfect by any means in relation to this, but it has become so much better in just coping with those moments where you get sort of the explosion, the flare up of that emotion, and then bringing it really back down and anchoring back into that and getting you essentially back on track more quickly, because you're absolutely right. The trading floor is dynamic, it's quick. And if you hit that low, but you're in the middle of the day and you've still got a lot to do, you know, trying to get back on course pretty quickly is also something that, you know, we work at quite hard, I think. And that's something that you develop over time.
It's a time thing, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's not, I don't think it's gender specific, actually. I think that those coping mechanisms, so for anyone in a stressful job, I think it's really important to have them. It's made a big difference to me.
Yeah. And trying to put them to one side and what you can and can't control. Yeah. And ultimately, hopefully you're getting it right enough of the time. If you're not, maybe you're in the wrong place. Mimi, can you tell us about your average day and what it looks like?
Yeah, so it's a little bit different. I miss the days that you described. I was just thinking, oh, I want to go back there. So I run a global team. And a lot of the conversations that I'm having are with the senior individuals within those teams about things that are going well, things that need fixing, sort of problem solving across the institution, but also connecting up different parts of the bank. So it's really interesting that my role now is a lot about internal relationships as well as the external ones. But the thing that gives me energy still is talking to clients. So I travel a lot. I go and see companies and investors all over the globe, and that is sort of like oxygen, because I learn a huge amount of what they're thinking and then therefore can bring it back to the teams and say, actually, let's change our approach on X, or have we thought about Y? But also, you know, that idea of going and seeing clients in their environment. A client in Japan needs to be covered incredibly differently to a US multinational. I see that really as my role, to kind of try and navigate that, both for the organization internally, but also for our clients, to help them get the best outcomes. So very different days, less routine, I would say, interspersed with lots of travel. And the reality is that if something goes wrong on the trading floor, my entire day is destroyed. So it will be about that thing. The difference today is that I can go into the office and have the best intentions as to what my day is going to look like, but actually it can be something completely different.
Yeah. So yeah, routine versus God knows what's coming. Curveball coming around the corner. Lou, don't let it come from you. I need to get some shit done today.
There is about.
And can you talk a bit more about navigating gender specific obstacles along the way? I mean, you're obviously both thriving at Barclays, but has it always been that easy? You must have had difficult conversations, difficult characters.
The environment that we're in has changed quite dramatically. And thinking about walking onto the trading floor sort of 20 years ago, I just remember some of the terrible advice that I was given, which was in an effort to try and make me fit in, but actually was probably completely the wrong thing to do. So for example, well, you know, if you want to be successful, you need to learn to play golf and probably, you know, become a bit more knowledgeable around certain sports. When in reality, you know, I could probably now strike up a rapport with the wall and I'd find some common ground.
I mean, it's funny how you can, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, we all as humans eat. We all go to restaurants. We've all, you know, lots of
TV, I think, is a lot more useful than sport.
Exactly. So, but it's funny in that people felt that that was the prerequisite to make you adjust into that environment.
That was a really beautiful thing, yeah.
Yeah, whereas actually now, I think, as we've sort of alluded to, it's very much the other way around, in that it's the fact that you're bringing something to the table that's different is very much lauded. So that, I think, is huge. But also the fact that women are being considered in the big decisions in running an organization. You know, how do we ensure that as people go through their careers, they have the opportunity to do things when they want to have children or are caregivers, etc.? Those considerations just weren't necessarily there 20, 30 years ago. And I think that that's probably the biggest shift. You're not having to remind people that you exist. You're very much the fabric of the trading floor.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Do you think that's fair?
No, definitely. And I think it's now about changing the perception around these are the great qualities that women have. Some of these might be different to qualities that men have. How can we kind of harness that and really use that to our advantage in building these more diverse organizations? And I think now in terms of, you know, your gender being an obstacle, it's almost the opposite.
Yeah.
I feel like we're very lucky to be kind of right place, right time mm-hmm. as women in finance. And it really feels like every door now is just opening for us. And, you know, the opportunity is definitely there.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, you've got to work hard to be able to make the most of it.
I remember Nicola Horlick years ago saying that if women wanted to be the icing on the cake, you know, they could. But actually, quite a lot of women were quite happy to sit at the marzipan level because they had children to deal with. But yeah, the time definitely is now, and there's no better time to go for it. Have you both had mentors within finance? Have you had female figures that have taken you under their wings, or male figures that have taken you under their wings?
Yeah, I mean, I think mentors are really, really important. I kind of first came across the concept when we had a talk when I was at Citi from a woman CEO of a huge asset manager. After that conversation, a guy called Connor Davis, who was very senior in sales at Citi at the time, we struck up a conversation about it. And he was like, well, Lou, I'd be very happy to be your mentor if you'd like me to. And he's been so instrumental, really, for me within my career, both in terms of growing my career at Citi. He was, you know, really the champion for my move from Credit Suisse over to Barclays. You know, I owe a huge amount to him through my career. And also he really helped me to be, you know, a bit more strategic in thinking about how I'm going to navigate this world and, you know, where do I want to be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, and how can I really set the best plan in place to achieve that.
And probably the male skills that he had really with you as a female. How cool that you have a male mentor. And actually I was a bit the same. And I think, you know, that they do make you look at things in a different way. And that, I think, was sort of made to think we need a female mentor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? I think we also often think that we need a mentor that's more senior than us. I think some of the people that have inspired me the most or sort of challenged me or made me see things differently are actually those who aren't on paper as senior as I am. And I can think of a smattering of people. Sort of there are men and women in my team currently who, when they walk into a room, I will ask them a question and ask them for advice, and it's just as valuable. Mm-hmm. And the way I sort of think about it is that often if you're looking up, if you're looking to sort of more senior people, you're sort of looking into the past.
Yeah,
you're looking into the future.
I so agree. I just had to write a quote for our editor-in-chief, Charlotte, we're putting her forward for an award. And in my quote, I commented on how often I sort of seek her counsel, yeah, and I value it so much. And yeah, just to your point, she's younger and comes at it with a fresher perspective.
So, yeah. So I think that's important, though, for us to kind of keep that open mind, because particularly as women in our industry, just by definition, statistically, there aren't that many people above us. There aren't that many women above us. So you have to sort of be a little bit broader, I think, in terms of who you're going to for that advice and that, I guess, inspiration.
We talked, when I came to your event, we talked about your peers and your network. And I remember it being a really good conversation. And yeah, and a point I've often made is, you know, cultivating that network really early on in your career, because you all sort of grow together and suddenly you're like, God, I'm surrounded, yeah, by these really amazing, well, men as well, but, you know, a lot of great women. Do you, how do you feel about that in a world of finance where perhaps there aren't as many around you? Has that been something you've consciously done?
Well, actually, at that event, it really resonated with me. It's stuck with me since, in terms of what an exceptional networker you are, in that you've thought about it, but also you've cultivated it over many years, which I think is really important, that sort of idea of authentically networking. Yeah. What I worry about sometimes is that, and that event, incidentally, was an excellent example of us trying to create a network of women across the industry. So not just Barclays focused, but looking kind of more broadly. But it does worry me sometimes that the perception of networking is that it's sort of a tick box exercise. Yeah, you know, yeah, I walk into a room, how many people could I possibly, yeah, speak to? But having those authentic connections, which then are followed up on, and there's a bit of give and take. I think we talked about that last time as well. You know, I should be getting something out of it. I'm a human being. I will invest in something if, yes, I'm getting something out of it as well.
It has just to go beyond networking, I think, doesn't
correct
it? It becomes, yeah, this sort of support group,
correct,
that pushes each other, that you go to in moments, and that drives you, I think, to achieve and,
yeah,
to keep,
yeah,
going. And they can be at the same level as you. I think that's...
Oh, 100%. And I think that not having that kind of barrier around it, but, you know, Lou, I think your story about how you reached out to so many people, but a lot of those individuals are still, you're still in contact with them now.
Yeah.
I think is a phenomenal example, actually.
No, I mean, I think, you know, what happened with me when I moved to Australia, and, you know, leveraging a network, which you may or may not have, you know, in that I very much reached out to every person I could think of, and emailed just, you know, every person I pretty much knew at the time. And you never know what's going to come from your network when you really kind of utilize it and make the most of it. And I think also don't be afraid to ask for help. Mm. You know, you never know how generous people can be, mm, with their time or with introductions or just, you know, with advice and guidance.
Yeah.
So I think the biggest thing is getting over that fear of asking.
Yeah. And it's amazing, you know, human nature is to want to help, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you'd be amazed how many people will. Can we just take it back to finance and talk a little bit more about a career in finance for other women that might be listening or making a change or who are in a similar industry to you. Is there specific advice you would give to them about succeeding? I mean, you're both killing it and incredibly impressive. What are the proactive things that people could be doing if they want to break into finance or thrive?
So a couple of things, I think. First of all, financial services organizations are very big and have so many different elements to them. So, you know, we'll think of a bank as either the bank branch or the trading floor, but not all of the things in between. You know, we've got a social media corporate comms person, we'll have HR, we'll have compliance. So being in a financial institution doesn't have to be just about those roles, I guess, that get the limelight. It can be anything. So that's number one. But most importantly, I think, you know, the thing that people probably don't realize is that when people come through the door for us at a graduate level or sort of for a senior hire, it's often not for their technical skill that they'll be hired. For me, in particular, it's about their attitude and their passion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's by far and away the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and having that sense of hustle, because I mean, the team always laughs at me because I'll sort of say, look, performance is capability times attitude squared. Like that for me, not I will hire for the attitude squared.
I love that. I knew you to write that down.
Every day of the week.
Performance is capability times attitude squared.
Yeah. I obviously stole that from someone. So we should probably steal it from you.
Yeah.
When you're coming into the industry, I would definitely give people the advice of learn as much about it as you can. And that's not from, you know, necessarily reading books or on the internet. Go and speak to people who work within the industry in different parts of it. Yeah. So people who work in asset management, people who work in broking like your brother, you know, people who work within a bank, and just try and get a little bit of an understanding of how different your day-to-day would be in all of those different roles and what's going to suit, you know, your skill set and what you enjoy doing. I think exactly as Mimi said, having the hustle is so important, but I think that that kind of resonates to so many industries. And then also for me, I try and be really targeted and make the most of my time when I'm in the office. So in the morning, I try and take a little bit of time just to make a bit of a plan for my day so that, you know, if I hit a bit of a slow point or haven't got a trade done yet for the day, that I can kind of go back to it and be like, okay, this is where I was going with my day and right, this is on to the next thing. So that you really are kind of targeted in your approach for every day as much as you can be.
Have you had moments of self-doubt? I'm sure you have. And if so, how have you dealt with them?
Yeah, I mean, when I took on the commodities business, I literally knew nothing about commodities. And so you've got to kind of put your mind in this. So there I am, new mum. I've got a 6-month-old at home. I've had a ton of bravado to ask for this job in the first place. And then I'm doing kind of my old job and trying to learn this new job where really I'm the senior person, but I might as well be the person doing the coffees. Like, I've got no idea.
Oh my God, said every, had every female going
so,
through that.
You know, and so I'm just sort of, so in that moment, sort of when you're on the floor, it was a lot about, you know, trying to play to my strengths. What are the things that I'm good at? You know, I'm good at forming relationships with people. I'm good at solving problems, which have nothing to do with commodities, right? Go back to the things.
And commodities for people listening.
Yeah. So at the time it was oil trading, essentially. For us, it was about oil derivatives. And, but going from foreign exchange, so currencies to oil, two very, very different things. But again, so I lent on my soft skills. I lent on the things that I knew deep down I was good at. But in those day-to-day moments, you kind of, yeah, you've got enormous amounts of doubt, let alone because you're then also having to go home and look after your new child and all of that kind of thing. But I think that's where you get strength from realizing what you can achieve. So I had no idea that that would be something that I could A, conquer or B, good at. And I'm pretty convinced, we were talking about this earlier, I'm pretty convinced that I would never have gone to the US if I hadn't have taken the risk there, because it taught me that I could push completely outside of my comfort zone and be in that moment where, you know, the wheels are partially coming off, you're not really sure whether you've got it all together. And then this moment where actually you feel okay again will come eventually if you work hard enough at it. And exactly the same thing happened in the US.
Do you think men have those moments where they think, okay, I'll push and it'll come good? No, my hunch is not so much.
Do you know what? I think that some men definitely do feel that, but would not feel vulnerable enough to necessarily have it in this conversation or podcast with you. That's for sure. But I actually, you do learn from the way in which they would tackle it, in that they're exceptionally good, and some of my colleagues are really, really good at this, of just making sure that their network or people around them help them.
Yeah.
You know, in senior positions, I think that one of the biggest things is to not be afraid to ask questions. And so that imposter syndrome, the biggest problem with imposter syndrome is that when you're going through that in your head is that you stop asking questions because you don't want to get found out. When in actual fact, you need to do the opposite.
Yeah.
You need to ask more questions. You need to get as much information as possible.
Yeah.
And that's really the difference between the two of us.
Yeah. I mean, that point resonates.
I mean, I'm all for questions, but it makes sense what you're saying. Yeah.
I mean, that point resonates with me so much. And Georgie, to what you were saying around the language around financial markets, how, you know, we have this very different language. Sometimes I wonder why. And, you know, you can go into meetings thinking, I have never heard of this before. I have no idea what we're talking about. You know, that you really are faced with new challenges and new information every day. And I think to your point around, you know, being intellectually curious, not being afraid to ask the right question.
Yeah, I'm cross on European Central Bank now. That's going to eat me alive.
But that's so important. And I think, you know, in our roles and in the industry more generally, intellectual curiosity and not being afraid to ask those questions is really key to success.
But you need a bit of self-belief, don't you, to have the courage to ask the questions. Can we talk a little bit more about motherhood and how you've navigated that? I mean, promotion and mat leave, that's pretty awesome. Quite right too.
Yeah, so my daughter's now 8. And the key thing that I can tell you is that it is messy, as I'm sure you know. So there is absolutely no point in painting this kind of perfect picture that everything is smooth all of the time. And actually, we've gone through different phases. So at the start, it was about juggling job and just new motherhood. Now it's actually about managing my travel schedule and so that my daughter doesn't feel that I'm away too much. So we have proper conversations about how, when am I leaving? When am I coming back?
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to preserve the weekends and that kind of
thing. Yeah, absolutely.
But it's interesting because everybody, or you'll hear people talking about the fact that they have a good support system around them or a tribe or however somebody wants to articulate it. But for me, it's around, can I set myself up to a space where I have enough headspace to do my job properly? So I will always have a little bit of my brain that's thinking about my daughter and school and has she got this or the pair of shoes or whatever. There's no chance that I'm going to switch that off. But can I give myself enough mental capacity to be able to do the job well whilst that kind of ticks?
And then can I shift it the other way when I'm home?
Correct.
Yeah.
And then do the other way.
I think that point, just because I so agree, I think it's such a good point, is recognizing that you're allowed to have that little bit of head.
Yeah.
I think I talked about this at your event. Like, I've realized those mothers who said, I just focus on parenting only when I'm with my child. And I'm like, I'm still a mother at work. And I'm still a working woman at home.
Yeah.
And allowing yourself 100%. And acknowledging that that's not failing. And that's who you are. And so allowing yourself that bit of headspace, I think, is a really nice way to put it.
It's so important, I think. Now, I do still have things that I think I could do better, sort of in the self-analysis. You know, sometimes I really do need to disconnect from work and be a bit more focused on my daughter, sort of in those moments where something has happened and you just sort of look at your phone, sort of it's those. I definitely could do a better job around having that separation. But equally, I think she can see, and I'm proud of this, she can see that it's important to me and that it gives me energy, it gives me a lot to be excited about, and it pays for all the holidays.
You've also got to live, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's, you know, and I wouldn't change that for the world. I like the messiness. I like the mixture.
And that's, you know, what we as women bring, spinning those plates. Are there particular strategies or boundaries that you've put in place that you can share with others? I'm listening, Mimi. You seem very composed.
I think in terms of strategies, no, I don't think there's anything that's universally successful. What I loved actually was a moment when I was in the United States and I'd been traveling a ton all over the US, and my team could tell that I wasn't spending anywhere near enough time at home. So we sort of came to an agreement that they would chuck me out of the office at least 3 days a week to make sure that I was there for bedtime promptly. And that sort of shared ownership was huge because I was my worst enemy in that scenario. I was the one that wasn't leaving. Nobody was making me stay.
I love that. That makes me quite emotional.
Exactly. It's huge. It's huge.
Because not feeling like you're not putting your weight amongst people who don't have children.
Yeah.
And them needing to understand that is part of you is a really...
It was unbelievable. And it was a game changer for me because it then meant that my psychology kind of changed around it. I wasn't only letting my daughter down, I was letting them down. And they were brilliant at just kind of saying, no, it's, we agreed, go.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, and actually we talked about this a bit before, but I also think it's really important, and I'm sure you bring this to your colleagues being in the senior position you are, but it's so important that it goes the other way.
Yes.
And that we as mothers are encouraging men to also own it and, you know, wear both hats, because the world is changing and, you know, there are more and more mothers who are the key breadwinners or the equal breadwinners and co-parenting and. So I think, you know,
it's huge.
Setting examples for men as well in your position is just so key for the future.
I think one of the guys on my team probably doesn't even really know it. I will make a note to tell him. But he, in the US, he's based in the US, and you have this concept that you can take parental leave as the primary caregiver regardless of gender. And he switched with his wife, so he took the full primary caregiver.
My brother switched with his wife.
Which I just, and you know, just set such a brilliant example. I felt like that was such a victory.
Yeah.
Such a huge moment for us to have crossed that threshold where he felt comfortable enough to do it. It's amazing for her. It's a game changer.
Yeah, my brother didn't switch with his wife, but he took a big chunk. And, you know, I had my first child 13 years ago. And, I mean, my husband took 5 minutes. And I would love to think now that it would be different. And it is really changing. And I think we've got to support them as they've got to support us.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about health and balance in life? I mean, you've been through the trading floor. I mean, we touched a bit on going home at the end of the day and knowing what you can and can't control. But, you know, life is pretty high pressure. Life on the trading floor, you know, new levels. And I sort of worry about, have we written a feature on makeup? I mean, Christ, it's quite different.
It's important. Yeah, what else would I read?
But the pressure and the impact of those highs and lows must be huge. How long have you done it for? How do you keep going? What's the key to self-care? I mean, I know it's quite a cliche, self-care, but it's so important. How do you navigate that?
No, I mean, it is so important. And I think for me, you know, it's all about striking that right work-life balance. And I try and do that by being as organized as I possibly can with my time. So, you know, I love working out. I love playing racket sports. Obviously, spending time with my husband and my friends is super important. So we're also expected to be out with clients, you know, twice, even three times a week. So, you know, it's really about managing that, juggling that, and finding a schedule that really works for you so that you can make the time for all the things that are important to you. You know, I think as you're a parent, it becomes even harder because you're throwing another kind of juggling ball into the mix.
Yeah.
But yeah, the way I go about it is just trying to be as kind of structured and organized as possible. I have a paper diary, which
you're one of those.
Crazy, yeah.
Always amuses me when someone gets out their paper diary.
But so I can really see, okay, what does my whole week look like? What does my whole month look like? And how am I managing this in terms of, you know, my workload? And just making sure that you've got enough time for, you know, yourself really as well as your job.
And how long do you think you can keep going on the trading floor?
I think a long time.
It's addictive, isn't it? People say, I'll do it for a few more years and then they're still there. You're like, you're still
there. With the fast-paced atmosphere you work in, with it being so loud and buzzy, I think going to something else would feel very quiet and just like a real change of pace.
Yeah.
And you almost become a little bit institutionalized in it. And, you know, for me, if you're one of the people where you feed off a really high-energy environment and being challenged every day, and, you know, having a different day each day and really having those different things thrown at you. For me, I couldn't see myself doing anything else, to be honest.
To the point that we discussed earlier, I can't imagine not having the noise.
Yeah. someone once said, I'm not for a second comparing Sherlock's with a Barclays trading floor, but I remember many years ago, just to be clear, many years ago, a friend of my stepbrother's, who's a little bit older than me, saying, gosh, how do you do it? It's like working at a newspaper, isn't it? Every day you get out, it's a new day, and you start all over again, and it's a race to the finish. I remember sitting there and going, God, I really wish you hadn't said that.
Yeah.
But there is this, and we're a daily. So I guess there's a little bit of that. There's massive drive. I can't imagine anything going so. You sort of thrive off the, the pace. 100%. And the,
definitely.
And there's an excitement of every day is a new day.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what that's not like, to feel like you don't know what's going to happen today and that. Yeah, I mean, it's a new day. Before we get to the end, I feel like we've there's so much more we could cover. I need to come back and do this 101 to the world of finance. But you're both, as I said, really at the top of your game. But are there resources, are there networks that you tap into, that you access, advice you'd share on staying ahead? Because being current and up to date and on top of things in your industry, you know, if you're ambitious, it's key, right?
Yep.
How do you achieve that, make time for that?
So I think that having the basics down of making sure that you access lots of different media to ensure that you're getting different perspectives is really important. But if you imagine that everybody reads the same 4 or 5 newspapers or Bloomberg or the FT, etc., there's a risk there that there's groupthink. So the biggest thing that I would say is making sure that you're bringing a different perspective. For me, I'm fortunate. We talked about it before. I get to speak to clients all of the time. They're giving me little snippets that I can put together that give me my edge. But for those who are looking and listening at the podcast, is always think about getting that other perspective, because otherwise it's super generic.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important.
Yeah.
And I think to Mimi's point, you know, we're surrounded by such impressive people in this industry, both internally and at our clients. You know, I work in the hedge fund sales team. I'm fortunate enough to be speaking to some of the most intelligent, well-read, forward thinkers of this industry on the hedge fund PM side. You can learn so much from content that you read, but actually a lot of the most insightful things that you can learn are just from the people around you. Mm. And as we were saying earlier, in terms of being intellectually curious, asking the right questions, you know, when you have these incredibly incredible people at your disposal, don't be afraid to ask them questions, you know, really pick their brains, get their perspective on topics. Because often you can learn just as much, if not more, from them as you can from classic outlets.
But it's interesting, Luke, because I don't think that it's somebody that is in a position where they're at a hedge fund or something. So some of the most powerful conversations that I have are with people who are in a completely different industry.
That's so true.
So I was in Atlanta recently, did a bunch of client meetings. And at the end of every client meeting, I make the point of asking, okay, what's it like for you in Atlanta at the moment? What's happening in the job market? You know, does your family, do your friends feel like they're going to lose their jobs? It might sound bizarre, but it's a really interesting and quick way to get a sense as to, oh, well, actually, as a human, this is how this person feels living in Atlanta. Now, I could read several publications potentially to get me that perspective, but it's real time. If you add up all of those little nuggets over a prolonged period, it kind of changes your perspective completely.
I so agree. Every new conversation you have with every new person on a new topic, you take something.
You
really do. And it's funny how it then comes back to you and you're like, God, that came up. It's that curious mind. And on a sort of personal development basis, I mean, you talked about your mentor. How do you keep pushing yourself personally, as well as staying up to date with industry news?
I guess for me, it's about making sure that I have those conversations with people who are more senior than me, but also, as we talked about before, more junior than me, to push me into a place where I'm not in my comfort zone anymore. I mean, if you look at the career moves that I've had and been lucky enough to have, each and every one sort of really challenged me. That's kind of in my nature. I will typically strive for that, but it doesn't have to be a job change. So it could just be something that in a particular project, I'll push myself and do something different within it, or I'll access a different group of people. I think it's really important. Lou used the phrase intellectual curiosity. That part, I think, is critical, regardless of grade, seniority, etc. Not losing that thirst for learning and getting a little bit more. That's probably the biggest thing for me.
Yeah, if you're listening, you take something away today. It's so rewarding. It's exhilarating, I think, isn't it? What does success look like?
God, that's such a hard question to answer.
It's a hard question, isn't it? But I think everyone's answers are so, like, so what's different. Your gut tell you?
You know, I think it really is so different for everyone. So I think, you know, happiness is all about setting goals for yourself that you feel are achievable, but also kind of being in that moment and not always thinking about, okay, what do I now want next? What do I want next? I think, you know, success is about thinking about where you want to be in the future, but also appreciating where you are right now. And also, you know, thinking back to yourself 5 years ago, looking at you and the position you're in now. And I think that can be really rewarding, just to reflect on, you know, where you feel like you've got to, and give you a sense of perspective of, actually, I'm so lucky to be in the position I am today. Yeah. So make the most of it and Really don't take anything for granted.
I think for me, it's two things. It's security. So, which sounds incredibly basic, but it's something that I'm absolutely driven by. Particularly, I think if you've come from a background where you haven't necessarily had that much, it sort of is a driving force. And it's something, incidentally, probably for another podcast, but how on earth do you get that into your children when they haven't got necessarily the same experiences?
That work ethic.
And then the other is progression. There's something about going from A to B and feeling like you've conquered something in a scenario. So this idea of winning and progression. So those are the two things for me, which have absolutely nothing to do with the trading
and
course specifically.
And you're winning your own race, though. That's, I think, so important. It's you against yourself, and everyone's interpretation of it is so different. And for some, that is a big part of lifestyle alongside their career and how the two play together. But yeah. Can you leave us with some parting words of wisdom? I feel like you have it in abundance, the pair of you. To ambitious women listening in the world of finance or otherwise, what do you say?
I think you said it perfectly, Georgie, that there's probably not been a better time than now for women in the financial industry. And really, it's about that intellectual curiosity, a bit of drive, and there will be something available for you if you really want to go after it. And I genuinely believe that the opportunities are in abundance now, and it's a really, really fun place to be.
Yeah, you've made it sound very fun. Nu, would you add anything to that?
You know, I think to what we were talking about earlier, there are so many different roles within the financial services sector. So many doors are open to you. You just have to, you know, hustle, work hard. Don't be afraid to ask for advice. Don't be afraid to ask the next question. I think it's a great career path for anyone who feels like it would suit them.
Ladies, amazing. I think you're both phenomenal, so inspiring and so glamorous. And we didn't even touch on that, but you've both got phenomenal personal style. Anyway, for another time, we need to get you back for a photo shoot. But anyway, thank you so much for giving up. I've got one final question, Nu. Did you go to work this morning before you came here?
Yes.
Did you do a trade?
Yes.
Woo! And that is a wrap. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed that, then do please rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends to listen too, and we will be back soon. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.